Welcome to Financial Repression Authority's Roundtable Insight, where the best fund managers, economists, and industry leaders discuss the key investment issues and challenges in the current macroeconomic environment.
Hi, welcome to FRA's Roundtable Insight. This is host Richard Benulli. Today is November 7th. We have returning guest Louis Vincent Gave of GaveCall, along with Ira Harris. Louis co-founded GaveCall in 1999 with his father, Charles, and Anatoly Kalitsky. Before co-founding GaveCall, Louis worked for Paribas Capital Markets, where he was an equity research analyst from 1997 to 1999. And he studied economics, history, and Chinese at Duke University and Nanjing University. And Ira is past hedge fund manager and global trader in foreign currencies, bonds, and commodities and equities for over 40 years. He has served as CME director from 1997 to 2003 and a stint also most recently. Welcome, gentlemen.
Great to be here.
Thanks for having us. Good to see you.
Great. Thought we'd begin, Louis, with your view on the global macro, on the economy and the financial markets.
Just with that, we could go for hours.
You put
a coin in that machine, I'm not sure I'll stop. Look, it's been a busy week. In fact, I'm reminded, you may remember this. Do you remember the movie Airplane from the late 70s or early 80s?
I love it. Yeah, and I do speak jive.
Yeah, exactly. I speak jive. Well, you may remember the guy who the guy who says, you know, I picked a hell of a week to quit drinking, picked a hell of a week to quit smoking, picked a hell of a week to quit amphetamines, picked a hell of a week to quit sniffing glue. And at the end, he's lying down on the ground. This week, I think if you look at what's happened, obviously we've got the U.S. election that's captured all the media attention, but it also seems like we've got the German government falling, which, you know, amidst all the news in the U.S., that's an easy one to sort of bypass, but, you know, it's still Germany. It's still important. You've got an unfolding fiscal crisis in both France and possibly the UK, with bond yields in both countries relentlessly rising. You have, of course, a Fed decision coming in today. And then finally, and for, you know, my part of the world, very importantly, on Friday, you get China's fiscal policy. And over the past few days, I would say expectations have ratcheted up that China's going to go big, that you're going to get a pretty big fiscal stimulus. So to answer your question, Richard, I think, what do I look at the world? You know, I look at the U.S. and, you know, all I see from President Trump is easing of fiscal policy, you know, promises of tax cuts, promises of more spending. What I see in China is roughly the same, you know, big fiscal stimulus. So you have the two biggest economies in the world by far, China and the U.S., that are likely to embark on very easy fiscal policy. Maybe it's no surprise that bond markets are selling off. You know, it's where we're in a world now where, you know, if everybody's stimulating, why would you want to own bonds? And I think that's where we are.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira?
I agree totally with that assessment. I think, you know, why would you want to extend your duration at all in this environment? Fiscal stimulus. The fiscal stimulus from the United States, first and foremost, has really kept the world going. Almost the inverse of what happened with China, right, from 2008 and 2009, which, you know, I think we've seen Xi kind of be leery of, because the Chinese really stepped on it big. They took on a lot of debt, but they held the world up when the world was cascading into a potential deflationary debt scenario that was going to be catastrophic. Yeah, of course, the Western Central Bank, the developed central banks did what they did, and we had some fiscal stimulus, but it was China who really stepped it up. And you saw, interestingly, the move in commodity prices. Gold had its first thrust up, of course, in response to that. So I think we're, I think that Louis, of course, is right on top of this. How does China get there? And I know that Louis covers this, you know, but we also did that hit with Pettis, Michael Pettis, Dr. Michael Pettis. I think China, and I want to hear Louis talk more about it, really goes down the Pettis road, which is they need domestic consumption. We have two different problems. The United States seems to have a supply shortage, and China, of course, consistently has a demand shortage. So the world works, but we don't get any rebalancing that way. So how are we going to go? Don't know. But Louis's first point is exactly right. We go back to, you know, he cites airplane outside Lenin when sometimes some weeks, decades happen, and some decades, week happen. And this is, I think we're in the throes of where decades are happening. You know, we have so much coming at us. So it is no week to stop drinking or whatever other choice you choose to
to get through the day.
Yeah. But it's a great time to be in global macro. And I'll tell you what, it's not only Louis. I watched, I reprised a Druckenmiller piece yesterday. And Stan is, and I think I look to him. We're the same age, but I look to him as such a font of wisdom in this realm. So it was the best half hour. It was the best 50 minutes that I had spent. It was great.
Yeah, that was a good one. Yeah. And that's
who you need to get onto this podcast instead of us.
Yes.
Stan Druckenmiller. It's
bring him on.
Get the teacher on instead of the students.
Yeah, that's right.
But maybe I'll check for a roundtable, all of us together. that would be cool. Continue on China. Do you think there's a paradigm shift happening in China from the sort of export model to domestic focus, and even parallel to that in the investment realm, from allowing or encouraging real estate ownership and migrating to more of a share ownership, like in businesses?
So I'm not sure the sort of export versus domestic consumption framework is actually that useful to analyze China. And I know that's the default one we use in the Western world, but let me suggest a different framework to really understand both their policies and what's been happening in recent years. And to understand what China's been going through in recent years, I think you have to go back to 2018, when the US government, when President Trump decides, look, nobody's allowed to export high-end semiconductors to China anymore. And this was a brutal shock to the entire Chinese ecosystem. If you were a Chinese leader at that time, you thought, okay, it's semiconductors today. Tomorrow, it could be chemical products, or it could be auto parts, or industrial robots, you name it. Very clearly, the U.S. is no longer having a trade war with us. They're having a tech war, and their aim is to confine our growth. So from there, the decision was taken at the very top, and every bank was told, look, no more loans to real estate. We're now lending only to industry. We're lending only to industry because we have to build resiliency and independence in pretty much every single industrial vertical, whether it be autos, whether it be nuclear power plants, whether it be industrial robots, you name it. Now, when China went down this path, it did trigger, as the banks stopped lending to real estate, it triggered a hell of a correction on real estate. And for 5 years, every piece of Western media just focused on this real estate pullback for a number of reasons that I'm not going to go into in the interest of time. And they were completely blind to what is actually a much more important macro development, which was that China was leapfrogging the West in industry after industry. So, for IRA down in Arizona, for anybody living in the US or in Canada, the fact that Shanghai real estate may go up or down 10% from here is not going to change your life. The fact that China is now producing very, very good cars for less than $10,000 a car, that's an absolute game changer. So what you've seen is China basically all of a sudden take control of pretty much every industrial vertical out there. And as it did, yes, China's trade surplus moved from 25 billion a month to 80 billion a month, where we stand today. Now, people look at this and say, oh, well, you know, they're promoting exports versus versus domestic consumption. But what they're first and foremost doing is promoting independence, resiliency, and you know, and making sure that the Western world can't trip up their growth. And so I would say, to some extent, you know, when I look at China's leapfrogging of the Western industry after industry, we've done this to ourselves. It's the law of unintended consequences at work. We thought we would trip up China by banning them from semiconductors. And what ends up happening is actually they get down to business, they invest more, they work harder, they put on enormous amounts of human capital into solving equations, and on the other side, they end up stronger. I'll give you a simple example of that human capital. You know, today, Tesla has about 90,000 workers globally around the world. BYD, in its R&D department, research and development department alone, has 110,000 workers. So there's more people working in BYD's R&D department than there are people working at Tesla. This is the shift that the Western world has missed. And, you know, talking about export-driven model towards consumption-driven model is actually missing the more important picture in my eyes.
Yeah, those are very good, insightful comments. Your thoughts, Ira?
No, I really can't add or subtract from that. It is what it is, and I think Lewis has a much better view than anybody else. And as his recent piece, which I advise whoever can get their hands on and read it, Prejudice and China, we have a prejudiced view. But I've thought that for a long time. But part of that is due to China. Because I think when China closed off Google and other operating systems, and I'm going back, 20 years? So they kind of opened up a cottage industry of how do you, you know, pin the tail on the donkey where you're kind of blind and you hope to catch the right number. So we're kind of left groping for it. So we try to develop models in the West based on what is really, of course, imperfect information. And that leads to some prejudice. But we also are directed, and I think Lewis's piece really gets into it, in the way the media and works with Wall Street, and they want to put out a narrative that fits what they're trying to sell at the time. And I think that we get caught in that bad situation. And I think that's right. So I've always had a hard time, because my tentacles just are not that long, investing in China directly. But what do I look at? I look at Australia, New Zealand. I want to know what's going on around there, because that gives me a pretty good story. Because what, and we're seeing right now, Australia is all of a sudden cozying up to China again for trade purposes. They were busy talking. In fact, the Australians, I read it quote somewhere the other day, were noting it, that things must be picking up, because the Aussies are trying a little bit harder to be on the plus side, but everybody's trying to refigure themselves. The Japanese are trying to figure how this is going to work too, and where do they lie with the United States? So I think that these, you need to really know and follow somebody like Gavkel, because they have quote unquote boots on the ground. They have a good eye for it than a lot of others. And you're not just sending a journalist over there to, you know, as they all get caught into the vortex of only talking to people who, number one, speak the language, and number two, that they see in the cities where they go, as Lewis points out. So I think this is very important. But if they're, and I think we need to watch, as we did in 08, see what commodities do here, because it's been a while since the Chinese have been aggressive buyers. I mean, at the beginning of COVID, they were, and Lewis and I think did one or two podcasts about it, and we could see that things were taking place. Why? Because the Chinese yuan, everybody thought it was going to weaken as China was trying to protect its export markets. And what happened? The yuan went from 720 down to 610. And everybody go, well, how can that be? They're trying to, the world's collapsing. They want to, no, they didn't. They were busy stockpiling and using a stronger yuan to do that. And so I'm looking at this here, and you know, I have the yen yuan chart up right now, you know, just on my desk. And I see, you know, we're back at 21.5 yen to a yuan, which is, you know, fairly strong yuan, but not overly so. But, you know, everybody talked about yesterday when the dollar rallied against everything after the Trump election because of the anticipation of tariffs. Well, hopefully we'll get into some of that discussion. But I'm watching yuan here because I think people's playbook is wrong. And if China is going down that consumption path or more domestic oriented path, that it needs to create a weaker yuan is not the answer. In fact, I would argue it going the other way, but I think a weak yen kind of holds them, locks them in here. But I'll stop there and you can see that.
Well, I'll just add one quick point here. First, I want to thank Ira for the very kind words, very generous of him. The paper he mentions, that Ira mentioned, is actually on my, I posted it without a paywall on my Twitter account. So people who follow me on Twitter, I'm Gav Vincent on Twitter. You can find the paper that Ira references. And yes, you know, I think Australia is actually, and to Ira's point, I think Australia is a very interesting country because it's one of the few countries in the Western world that has actually not turned protectionist against China. You know, as China has leapfrogged the West in industry after industry, the typical response, whether in the US, the EU, Canada, the UK, when China says, hey, do you want cheap cars? The response in most of the countries is no, we can't handle your cheap cars. We want to protect our own car industry. But of course, Australia doesn't have a car industry. So when China comes down and says, hey, do you guys want cheap cars? And you guys want cheap industrial robots? Australia says, yep, thank you very much, mate. That sounds great. And so they'll take the cheap cars every day of the week. Now, the reason this matters is that if, like me, you believe that China leapfrogging the West in the industrial realm is one of the most important macro trends out there, then the world is really right now in front of our very eyes splitting into different parts. There's a part of the world that is embracing this extra deflation coming from China, that is saying, you know what? I love a cheap nuclear power plant. Thank you very much. I love cheap railways. I love cheap cars. Send me as many as you can. And in those countries, whether it's Latin America, whether it's Southeast Asia, whether it's the Middle East, whether it's Australia, New Zealand, in those countries, you can actually own the bonds. You can own the bonds because inflation in those countries is going to stay muted. Then you have the countries like the US, EU, Canada, et cetera, that says, you know what? I don't want to deal with your deflation. I'm going to put up massive trade barriers. And the reason this matters tremendously is that for the past 30 years, China was the main deflationary force in the world. And so when these countries turn around and say, take your deflation elsewhere, I don't want it here, in essence, they're saying, I'm going to have higher structural inflation rate from here on out. And then, of course, in that environment, if your country, if your policymakers are saying, I'm going to embrace a set of policies that ensures there's going to be higher inflation from here on out, why would you ever want to own the bonds there? And I think that's what the market is waking up to. That's why you've seen the biggest sell recently. You've seen the biggest sell-offs in places like France, like Germany, like the UK, like the US. Today, if you have to own bonds, you want to own them in Australia more than, and if it's you have to own sort of OECD bonds, I would own Australia before anybody else.
Meet the Cedar Owl, a new economics and finance publication with a focus on environmentalism. We combine the Austrian School of Economics and market environmentalism principles for investing in a sustainable future. Follow the link in the description to get to know the Cedar Owl better, understand our values, our mission, exactly where we're coming from, and the type of content that we release on a cyclical basis every Thursday. Join us in targeting outperforming portfolio returns while making a positive impact on society and the environment through technology. Subscribe now for weekly insights, investment articles, and exclusive content.
So we had the U.S. elections yesterday. And there was a lot of talk about reindustrialization of the U.S. or reshoring. And to what you said, Louis, what are your thoughts? Like, how is the U.S. going to handle this from an economic strategic perspective, given China has superiority on the industrial area and also graduates, you know, more engineers than every year in China than there are engineers in the U.S. every year, right, on a yearly basis. So, you know, lots of engineering innovation happening already in China. Is it going to be initially through tariffs, or like it takes a generation likely to train everybody more with a focus in engineering and science and math? Your thoughts?
So obviously it's early days in the incoming Trump administration. We don't know who's going to get appointed to what jobs. And some of these appointments, I think, will be very telling of where Trump ends up going. Because there's really two paths for the possible U.S.-China trade relationship. One of them is the path advocated by somebody like Robert Lighthizer, who says, look, we need to put in massive tariffs, 60, 70, 100%. We need to take the pain up front of an economic divorce from China that would be a permanent divorce. So yeah, that means we go through stagflation, weak growth, higher inflation, but for the long term, that'd be better. Mm-hmm. So that's the sort of Robert Lighthizer outlook. And then there's, you know, the outlook of somebody like, say, like Scott Bessent, who's widely rumored to be Trump's Treasury Secretary, who says, look, we got to beat up the Chinese a little bit so that we get a good deal out of them. And they revalue their currency and we move forward in a more harmonious, less disjointed fashion than we do today. Now, I tend to believe that Trump will go towards the second route because I can't imagine Trump, you know, Trump is here for 4 years. He's here for a short time. He's here for a good time, not a long time. I don't think he's the kind of guy to take his medicine up front, to take the pain for the long-term gain. And so, you know, I think that, you know, the U.S.-China relationship has been broken for the past 6-7 years. And for me, the big question is, does it get worse from here? Does it stay bad? Or does it actually improve? Do we get some kind of grand bargain? Now, I think the odds of a grand bargain are actually decently high. When I listened to Trump on the campaign trail, he was at pains to highlight that China is a competitor, that it's not an enemy, that he's got a great personal relationship with Xi Jinping. You can find dozens of quotes where he says that Xi Jinping and himself have a very strong working relationship. He even calls him a friend a few times. And I'm not sure that Xi Jinping would call Trump a friend, but that's a whole other debate. But more importantly, I think what was very interesting in the campaign in the last 3 months of the campaign, Trump was very adamant that he wanted BYD to open factories in Michigan and Li Autos to open factory in Tennessee. And he kept coming back to this. And I think this corresponds to a very important reality of the U.S. Economic situation today, specifically the growing realization within Washington, D.C., that in deindustrialization has gone too far in the U.S. Now, of course, there's two reasons why D.C. thinks it's gone too far. You've got people like J.D. Vance who argue, look, we have 70,000 people a year dying of deaths of despair, killing themselves with opioids in the Rust Belt, in the Appalachia. We need the blue-collar jobs back for these people as a matter of social policy. Now, of course, you could have made this point any time in the past 15 or 20 years, and most people in Washington, D.C. didn't care that people in the Rust Belt were killing themselves. What has changed for people in Washington, D.C., is a second massive shift, aside from the 70,000 people dying of opioids a year. The second thing that has changed dramatically for D.C. is the realization that in a war with a major military power like Russia, the U.S. now can no longer produce the weapons. You know, when Russia invaded Ukraine, we, the combined Western world, I'm French, and we said, to Ukraine, stand up and fight. We'll provide you all the weapons. Russia is a gas station masquerading as a country. We're going to turn the ruble into rubble. And then within 6 months, we found out that Russia was outproducing the combined Western world in artillery shells 3-1, that Russia was outproducing us in tanks, that it was outproducing us in artillery pieces. I mean, you name it, and Russia was outproducing us. And then DC started to look into it and said, hold on, for every one ship that the US produces, China can produce 200. Now, the reality is that wars between great powers are really wars between industrial capacity. You know, the reason the Western world, the Allies, won World War I and World War II was that the US was an industrial juggernaut. And this isn't to take away from the valor of the men who fought those wars. You know, they fought very bravely, whether on D-Day or at Bastogne, et cetera. I don't want it to sound like I'm taking away from that. But the reason we still won those wars is we swamped Nazi Germany with equipment on both sides. The US provided the equipment to the Soviets, and it provided the equipment on the Western front as well. And so today, you know, I think we could ask the question, can the US be the world's military hegemon when it produces less than 4% of the world's steel? You know, and the answer is no, as we're finding out with this war in Ukraine. The answer is actually no. And so I think in Washington, D.C., the realization is, hold on, we have to reindustrialize. And today, and to your point, Richard, I don't think you can reindustrialize without some of China's help. Because to reindustrialize, you need the 45-year-old workers to train the 20-year-old workers. Look at the difficulties the U.S. is having in just producing semiconductor fabs in Arizona. They're pouring tens of billions into it and, you know, basically getting nowhere. So I think the potential for a deal with China is there. I doubt the relationship goes worse. At worst, it stays even at very bad, but it could actually improve. And if it improves, what I've learned in my career is that when a situation goes from being very, very bad to just mediocre, you make a lot of money. You know, because if asset prices are priced for things being terrible for as far as the eye can see, but all of a sudden it's like, oh, actually, you know, this thing isn't going to go bankrupt, or this thing isn't going to keep deteriorating. Then you can get a massive re-rating of assets. You know, I think most people make the mistake of saying, oh, I need things to be very good for me to invest in. No. You buy things when they're terrible, and just to move from terrible to mediocre. Now, of course, if you go from terrible to very good, then it's an absolute home run. But you know, that's pretty rare in a career that you go from terrible to very good quickly. You go from terrible to mediocre, mediocre to decent, then decent to good, and then good to very good. It's like a slow moving process. But that'd be my take on the U.S.-China relationship today.
Great insight. Your thoughts, Ira?
Well, yeah, I think Lewis hits all the points. And if we go back, you know, this is why policy needs to always leapfrog personalities. Because if you go back to April of 2023, Jake Sullivan delivered that speech at Brookings on Biden's new industrial policy. When you really read through what he presented, it was so much of what the Republicans wanted. And actually, Trump had talked about in 2020, it was so much of that, and everything that Lewis talks about is, you know, rebuilding up U.S. industrial strength through various techniques, and why they didn't, both sides, why there wasn't a bipartisan push for some of that. It's like they couldn't give credit to the Biden team, and the Biden team couldn't give any credit. So we wind up really doing nothing. It's a nice laid out policy that doesn't take place, but Lewis is right. And then, of course, we have the ridiculousness of CFIUS, which we'll see how Trump plays with that. The Biden White House, you know, the Committee for Foreign Investment in the U.S. And now we have Japan. Japan is considered a top-tier ally in all things. And here they want to buy U.S. steel, Nippon Steel, which, when I first read the concept that, okay, they're coming in, They're much better producers, more efficient producers, lower carbon producers of steel because of the techniques that they use. And the union wasn't really opposed to it because Nippon is a really good operator. And here you get both sides saying that they're blocking them. The original deal was priced at $54, supposedly, if it could take place. It didn't. The stock broke down. Everybody who loaded up broke down to 27. Interestingly, 2 days after the election, that Nippon, I think, closed at 41 or 42 yesterday. It's had a $3 or $4 rally this week really quickly. So it's something to watch. But moving more efficient producers, because we haven't been, it's not like U.S. Steel has been a great run company for all these years. You know, kind of what we're seeing with Boeing. You know, we need top-notch, first-class industrial policies. And as Lewis talks about, China produces a lot of engineers. STEM education is a huge thing in China. In fact, you see it whenever I've lectured at University of Illinois for Professor Waspy, and I've been at Northwestern and at University of Chicago. The most energetic students in the higher level classes are the Chinese students because they want to learn. They want to know. The American students sit there, they take notes. There's really very little interaction. It's the Chinese who get the class going. You know, they want to know this and that and this and that. One of the things, the last time I lectured, it's been a while, we talked about how China and China's consumption patterns have bent the global grain curve upward forever. When we used to fall back to $4 or $5 soybeans, $3.50 wheat. I mean, we've seen this year was a huge crop in the US, but where did soybeans get down to? $9.50? And that's with Brazil, the biggest producer. So that curve has been built, has been pushed upward forever. And who engaged in it were the Chinese. We talked a lot. They were so engaging. Nobody else cared a lick about it, but there's reasons that the Chinese, of course, care about it. And I was hoping in today's South China Morning Post, they talk about U.S. Grain being a very viable import for the Chinese still. And you see low grain price, but the beans are starting to move up here a little bit. They're interesting to watch. I'm waiting to hear from Adam Rosenzweig about how I've been following the drought down in South America, and China's going to have to protect itself because, again, and Lewis can expound on this far better than I can, China will never be short of food. It can never happen again. They will do everything. Lewis, yeah. Can you speak on that?
Yeah. Look, you know, when you look at China's own history, you know, people were starving in China up until the 1960s. So, this leaves pretty fresh scars. And you know, since then, I think that the Chinese government has done a decent job, and as China's gotten richer, building massive amounts of inventories. You know, China actually has a strategic pork reserve, for example, which always makes foreigners laugh. But you know, the price of pork matters tremendously in China. You know, half of the world's porks are eaten in China. And so, you know, having the ability to sort of massage any price spike in food prices has been a very important policy tool for Chinese governments. Now, having said all this, so, you know, as China's gotten richer, China started consuming more protein and importing food. Having said that, you've also had tremendous improvements in China's agricultural productivity. And you've had enormous amounts of investments building canals, bringing waters to region that were, you know, rapidly desertifying, where the desert was moving forward, bringing, in essence, water from the south to the north. And you've also seen China cut deals in Africa for agricultural land. You've seen China cut deals with Russia for food. So, you know, if you look at today, the threat of food in China is much less than it would have been 10, 15 years ago, both because domestic productivity has gone up on the back of massive investments because they now have, you know, other providers than just your big three of Brazil, US, Canada, and also Australia, I guess. The supply is now much more diversified. You also have Russia, you have Africa. So it's not to say that the Chinese government isn't going to care about food. They do. It's super important. They fully realize that when food prices spike, social harmony is hurt, and you might get demonstrations in the street. People get angry, etc. So managing the price of food remains a government priority. But I think they have more tools to do that than they've had at any time in the past 70 years.
Great. If we can go back to a discussion from the charts that have been graciously provided by Judd Hirschberg, he's chief investment strategist, the trading room that Ira and I participate in, and just your thoughts on the implications of the U.S. elections and trends you see in various asset classes, Louis?
Yeah.
What are your thoughts there on equities?
Look, what is it? I think U.S. equities are up 11 out of the past 14 quarters. I think if I look at U.S. equities today, U.S. equities, the U.S. market cap is roughly 2/3 of global market cap. It's also 1/3 of global profits for an economy that's roughly 22% of global GDP and population that's 4% of global population. So I think you could say, well, because the U.S. has better companies, it's got, you know, the Microsofts of this world, the Apples of this world, etc. The reality today is you're paying the full price for that U.S. exceptionalism. The belief in U.S. exceptionalism is super high today. Or it's either that or the fact that there's just, you know, too many dollars in the system. And that if you're a foreigner, putting your excess dollars in U.S. treasuries is no longer that attractive a proposition. But putting your, you know, dollars in, say, Microsoft, shrinking the share count every year might be a more interesting idea. Still, you know, here we are. We've got stocks that are, you know, frankly, fairly punchily valued at a time when long rates are moving up and moving up very rapidly. And so it's I don't think U.S. equities are the best of setups today. I tend to like markets when they're trading at low multiples and the earnings themselves are depressed, and you get interest rate support. Now today I actually find this in China. You know, I've got a cheap market trading at bottom earnings, and I have massive policy support and falling interest rates. In the U.S., you've got pretty much the opposite, right? You're paying up for stocks at top of the cycle earnings at a time when interest rates are going up. Yeah, I think I'm not saying it's bad right now. They've got all sorts of momentum, but it's for anybody taking a bit of a long term view, I don't think that's the best of setups.
Are you still bullish on emerging markets? We're now showing Argentina.
Very much so.
Yeah,
very much so.
Which ones? I think most. Yeah.
To be honest, all of them. I mean, they each have different stories. Within the broader emerging market space, perhaps the one that's got a little more headwinds today is Mexico, especially if you get a China-U.S. deal, because Mexico's benefited so much from the U.S.-China tensions. But Argentina's obviously got a great political catalyst. I actually think Brazil is dirt cheap, and you know the market is going to start pricing in the fact that Lula is very unlikely to run again, and that in 2 years' time we get a new election. And very often, sort of 2 years before the election comes in, people start pricing in what's going to happen on the other side in Brazil. So I think Brazil's interesting. I think China's interesting. India is an expensive market for sure, but it's a market that's being pushed higher by domestic savings. It's hard to see how that stops until oil gets to $100. I mean, Indian bull markets always end the same way. They end when oil prices go through the roof and India gets squeezed. But, you know, as long as oil prices don't shoot up, India's fine. You know, beyond that, you know, what are your other big markets? You know, it's South Africa, you could say, is a mess, but it's priced as a mess. If you're a little bit bullish on commodities, it's a fairly obvious play. And you also have the reality that they seem to have dealt with some of all their electricity shortages, and all the outages seem to be behind us. I think you look around the emerging market space, you can make a pretty compelling case for most of the big markets out there.
Bullish on gold and precious metals?
Look, I've been very bullish on gold. I think structurally you need to remain gold. I think people's allocations still aren't there. I also tend to believe that the real buyer of gold remains central banks, especially central banks in Asia and in the Middle East that tend to be fairly price insensitive. Having said that, look, I think it's obviously had a hell of a run. I think it's basically posting its best every year. So look, I think we are in a structural bull market, but given the run we've had, you know, could we have a pullback, especially in the face of, you know, higher bond yields in the U.S. And potentially in the face of a U.S.-China deal? You know, if we ever get a U.S.-China deal, a lot of the buyers of gold have been in China because they didn't know what else to do with their dollars. But if you have a U.S.-China deal, I think a lot of money will stop flowing into gold and will start buying Chinese assets instead. So it's I have, on a 5-year view, I think you want to be long gold. Do you want to be long gold for the next 6 months? I'm less sure.
Interesting. And your thoughts, Ira, on these markets?
Well, yeah. Coming to that, I mean, especially we haven't talked about Europe yet, and there's so much going on in Europe, but and I think that may be putting some upward pressure on gold too, because gold has been inexplicable to myself, because usually when you get real yields, positive real yields, like you've had in the United States, let's say, let's use just 2% real yields rather than positive real, rather than negative, gold really struggles, and it hasn't struggled. So as Lewis points out, there's buyers out there, and there have been buyers. If you buy gold for an inflation argument, it's been, then you have to look at yourself and go, well, inflation has been coming down everywhere. I mean, we had rate cuts. The Swedes cut 50 basis points this morning. The Brits cut 25. We'll probably get 25 from the Fed, and what they'll do with quantitative tightening may be the bigger issue, especially with the bond market that's shaking a little bit. And they may need some help, you know, by removing themselves from letting $25 billion a month roll off. But gold ought, and I use the philosopher's ought, not to be doing this, but yet it does. So as a trader, you trade that way, because when something shouldn't be happening and it keeps sustaining itself, it's telling you some story, whether you can see it or not. But it's not an inflation story. I've argued for 30 years, it's a central bank credibility story, good or bad. And I think the central bank's credibility has been shaken, if not stirred, as long as we're not talking about bonds. So I can use that phrase, shaken, not stirred. So that has put upward pressure on it. And again, the uncertainty. And the uncertainty coming from, as Lewis hints at, with the global south. And I agree with the emerging markets, which I think are moderately priced, but I think there's going to be competition for the global south, because China has made for competition, because they've had a structural plan and have adhered to it. And everybody else has kind of been left, where are we going to go here? And so I really think there's going to be an aggressive competition for those markets. And it's not the markets of the 50s, 60s, and 70s, when you were coming out of a neocolonialist or a colonialist past and living neocolonialism. You're going to have them where they're going to be wanting much better terms. And I think you're seeing that. I think Argentina is really worth watching. I think Lula, Brazil is really interesting, because Lula may be the best navigator on the global scene, where Lee Kuan Yew used it, but I watched Lula. Lula is no fool. He knows what he's got here and he's playing it. Yesterday was interesting because with the Trump election, the real went up and made the real went and made all-time lows yesterday, only to reverse even prior to when the Brazilian Central Bank raised rates 50 basis points. But we had a range in the real from about 6.20 on top down to about I think at the low was 5.60 later in the day. So something different. And right now we're sitting at 5.64. So interesting days. As you know, these are it's no time to stop drinking.
Yeah. And just a last question, Louis, on energy equities. What are your thoughts on oil, natural gas, even uranium, nuclear for investments? And prior podcast discussions, you mentioned the anti-fragile feature of energy equities versus U.S. Treasury bonds.
Yeah, and I still think that's true. I still think the risk in the system is that energy prices spike. That as long as energy prices don't spike, you know, your investments do fine. The equities that you want to own, whether in Japan or in China or in the U.S., I think all these stocks do fine. What could potentially derail us is energy prices spiking, which is why I'd much rather own energy stocks than bonds to cushion against a hit that may be coming. Now, you know, what's interesting to me is as President Trump got elected, oil prices went down, but energy stocks ripped higher. And that was a sort of a divergence that I hadn't seen in a while. And now you could say, well, nobody owns them anymore. They're so beaten up. Everybody hates them. It could have been short covering because everybody was short these things. You know, yes, all possible explanations. Nonetheless, you know, I think when I look at energy stocks today, you have stocks that have been unloved, beaten up, you know, very attractively valued, generating good cash flows. A lot of them are doing share buybacks rather than digging new holes in the ground. So, you know, you can own those things again as an insurance policy against an energy price spike. If the energy price spike doesn't come, then fine, you've earned a dividend over there and you'll have made money somewhere else.
Great. And your final thoughts, Ira?
I agree in everything that Louis saw yesterday when the energy stocks started going higher. Few things happened with Trump, right? Copper got hammered. Copper got hammered. Now it's back. It's had a pretty good move today. Gold got hammered. Silver got hammered. Things that we would equate to alternative energy. Copper was an alternative energy because, of course, electric vehicles. Outside of Tesla going up yesterday, it was not a good day for electric vehicles and alternative. You know, the wind companies, they were miserable. But interestingly, what had gotten hit off of that FERC decision, but nuclear energies rallied yesterday with the other energies. So I really, as copper was going down, so it was like the green energy stocks took a hit. I'll tell you what else took a hit. Ballard Power and Plug, they got hit pretty hard because, again, the money wasn't going to go there. It's going into drilling. And so, yes, that was definitely taking the case, and it's to be watched as we go. He's not going to cut off funding to the alternative energy groups, but there may just not be as much of it and so much as is pegged to that. So we may well see. So I saw that yesterday. Now it's unwinding differently right now. But I think there's going to be mega amounts. I understand the banks took off. I mean, we had a huge rally in global banks, you know, well, especially, but U.S. banks more than anything. I mean, J.P. Morgan was up 10% yesterday. This is no small, this is a huge thing. Why? Because there's going to be a change to Basel III. And we at Lewis and I haven't even gotten it. You know, I know he's got to go, so we're going to end it here. But all this lays out huge potential for potential trades and investments as we go here. And the view on the dollar, I'm not as bullish as, you know, and we haven't even gotten to that now. And you got to go dust off, you know, Scott Bessent. He was in, there's a chapter.
I'm really sorry, guys. I gotta
okay,
run.
Okay, I know.
I apologize. No, but Ari, you can stay. You can say, all right, I'm so sorry that I have to run.
So, thank you so much, Louis. Thank you so much. And we'll put a link to how.
Thanks, thanks for taking the time.
It was great. Thank you.
Thanks, guys. Yeah.
Thank you.
The FRA Roundtable Insight Show is for informational and educational purposes only and should not be considered as a solicitation or offer to purchase or sell any securities. The investments, investment strategies, and investment philosophies discussed or presented on the show each involve their own unique risk factors, which are not discussed on the show. Any discussions among the panel participants or responses to listener inquiries are based on the personal opinions of the panel participants and do not take into consideration the listener's suitability, objectives, or risk tolerance. Please be advised that you invest or speculate at your own risk. We'll be right back.